Thank you, Lord Father. We praise your name in all the earth. And he's coming back real soon. Keep Israel in prayer as our president's going to be visiting with the Prime Minister of Israel beginning this Wednesday. He's flying out Tuesday. And he's going to, quite a bit of speculation out there is what he's going to be telling Prime Minister Netanyahu. But you can be sure that what's taking place right now is going to continue to lead up to that, focus of the world's attention upon Jerusalem. It's only going to increase because the intensity, the greatest tension in the world right now is centered in the Middle East with Ahmadinejad of Iran, the president. His election is coming up in June. There is another, his term is up, by the way. He's had two terms. And so they're having new elections coming up in June. I'm real curious as to how that's going to come about. We don't know if he's a strong man. Maybe he'll force his way. Maybe he'll convince him for a third term. I don't know. He doesn't get along too well with really the powerful, the real leader of Iran is the raghead guy. What's his name? Khamenei. There's Khomeini and Khamenei. Khamenei is the current leader of Iran. He's the guy that pulls the strings. Ahmadinejad is more of a figurehead. He's just sort of a, but he's done a lot of dances out there that have gotten the leadership there shook up. He's used a lot of rhetoric, the United Nations, to put them in an awkward position. Yet I don't believe that the leaders are against what he said because they're called 12ers. The word 12ers is simply a description of the leadership and their mindset and how they think. They're 12ers because they believe that the imam that has a rightful possession to the caliphate, the leader of all of Islam, is going to come. Maybe you've heard of the Mahdi, but that's his name, a term that's used for the last seen relative of Muhammad, the one who died as a little boy, but he didn't die. He's hidden in a well or a cave or whatever. There's so many different stories. I don't know which one to believe. But he's going up here, and according to the 12ers, of which Khamenei, the Ayatollah of Iran, and the leader of Iran, the Ahmadinejad, believe that he's going to come on the scene in the middle of a great catastrophe, world catastrophe, which they're trying to get going. But they do have conflict, just so you know. The leaders of Iran don't like each other too well. They don't get along very well. Ahmadinejad is apparently trying to use his power that he's gained to try to push his agenda. And so there's struggles going on over there. It's not all nice and neat, as you might think. That, of course, their mantra is to wipe Israel off the face of the map. That's their goal. And to usher in the next caliphate. Now, all the word caliphate means is that they will be the head honchos of Islam, of the 1.5 billion followers in the world. The last caliphate that was in power was the Ottoman Turkish Empire. The caliphate was censured there in Turkey. That fell apart with World War I. Islam then withdrew. Islam woke up in 1979 with the jihad of Iran. You remember our embassy was taken over. If you haven't seen the movie Argo, that's all about that event where our embassy was taken over. We have not had any diplomatic relationships with them since then. And Islam woke up in 79 and it was accelerated with the defeat of the Soviet Union so he says, Osama bin Laden, so he said, not says, said. So we see Islam rising up again, and Iran wants to be the leader. This is a Bible study. It really is. We'll get to that. And he's a leader of the Shia, a sect of Islam, the next largest sect next to Sunni Islam, which is the largest sect of Islam, which is headed up by Saudi Arabia and Egypt. They're Sunnis. They want to control Mecca and Medina, and also the Al-Aqsa Mosque, or the Holy Shrine in the Temple Mount, which they call the Third Holy Shrine. By the way, there's so much here, I don't even know where to tie. I'm just giving you a little summary of what's happening. This week is a big week because it's all coming together. President Obama needs to get involved in the middle of it. He wants his legacy to be a good legacy, I'm sure, like any president would want a good legacy. And so they believe that his goal will be to focus in on the foreign affairs and leave a legacy in that arena, like so many second-term presidents have had tried to leave a legacy in that arena. He did his domestic job on us, which we'll learn about in the next few years with Obamacare. We're going to be finding out about that in the next few years. But his focus is probably going to go into foreign affairs, and we'll see how that works out. Not to get political here, but the fact is that politics do play a role in the overall end times events. So be in prayer for Israel as our president goes to visit with them, speculation including arm twisting concerning the discontinuation of the building of settlements in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and other issues as well. I'm sure Iran will be there. That's Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel. His number one concern is Iran. He'll bring that up. And so we have a very interesting events coming up here. I will be doing a prophecy update while Pastor Mark and Sherry are on Baction. Baction. Yeah, did you see the bulletin? Vacation. Yeah. Charles, is that a new word, Baction? Yeah, okay. Anyway, you leave one little letter out, and that's what happens. So he's going to be on vacation. I'm going to be doing the Saturday night and Sunday morning message on April 6th and 7th. Going to do a prophecy update, and I'm looking forward to a lot of new stuff coming out. Just so much information. It's like Pastor Chuck and Don Stewart, when they do the World News Briefing every week. There's so much information, where do I start kind of thing. So be in prayer about that as to what our focus will be on. Pastor Mark sort of gave you an update this morning on what I covered with the men's prayer breakfast. So anyway, let's go to Genesis 41. Now, in the book of Genesis, we've been doing a prophetic survey, and we've been trying to focus in on the prophetic aspects of the book. We're now in a section that is more narrative than anything concerning the story of Joseph. And it's really, we can look at, look at chapters 39 through 45 as a unit dealing with the life of Joseph, but especially chapters 41 to 45 is our five chapters that deal specifically with Joseph's ascendancy to the head of Egypt, shy of the Pharaoh's power, and he's going to be put in a position of authority. And by the time we get to 45, he's met up, he's been reunified with his brothers and his family by the time we get to 46. And so what I want to try to do tonight is to look at these chapters and go through them quickly so you get the big picture. I'm a big picture guy. I don't like to get too bogged down into details that are not really relevant. In our particular case, our focus is a prophetic survey of the book of Genesis. But before we do, I want to sort of give you the bottom line of where we're headed. Turn with me to chapter 45, and I'll show you really where we're headed in these chapters. And look at verse 3. Now, Joseph it's going to be a lot of intrigue here as we look at events that will transpire after Joseph ascends into power in Egypt, when he confronts his brothers, over some things as there's a famine and all. We're going to see in chapter 41. Now, that famine plays out actually through 45. The impact of this famine that is coming to Egypt, all five chapters are sort of surround this. And Joseph, he had disguised himself, and he didn't have to work too hard at it, but when his brothers showed up, he happened to be there. Oh, I wonder how that worked out. You know, that he just happened to be there and his brothers show up because they leave Canaan. Their father, Jacob, sends them to Egypt to get some food for them with what money they had left. And they just happened to meet up with their brother, Joseph. But they don't recognize him because it's been 22 years. The last time they saw the brother Joseph was when he was 17 years old, when they sold him into slavery to get rid of him because they really hated him. And yet, obviously, it was a hate-love relationship. They felt guilty about it. Obviously, it's their brother, for heaven's sakes. It's their brother. And yeah, brothers do have a love-hate relationship. I had two brothers. We were fighting a lot. I'm just telling you the truth. When we were kids, we did a lot of fighting. I have scars on my face to show you that you can see clearly. And we loved each other. You know, if anybody dared come after my brother, or if they dared come after my older brother, man, watch out. You know, you don't mess with the brothers. But then you know how it works. And it's the same with them. They're no different. They're like everybody else. And so Joseph, when the plot is finally unveiled, and we learn that Joseph, in fact, is the one that they actually had sold into slavery. This is 22 years later, as we look at verse 3 of chapter 45. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" Now that, up to this point, it's a pretty amazing deal that's going on. He finally reveals himself to his brothers after putting him through this back and forth stuff, going back to the to Canaan, then coming back to Egypt and so on. "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" But his brothers could not answer him. They were dumbfounded, for they were dismayed in his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come near to me." So they came near. Then he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years, the famine that has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God, and he has made me a father to Pharaoh." In other words, Pharaoh looked up to him like a father, much the way Nebuchadnezzar, remember Nebuchadnezzar, 1,200 years later, will make Daniel like his father in a sense. He looked up to Daniel. Here we have the Pharaoh looking up to Joseph. And notice, "and Lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt." Hurry up, go home, get Dad, bring him back, and we can get on with this thing. Now, I wanted to take you to really the conclusion of this story that starts back in 41. I wanted to, it's sort of like now we're going to do a flashback. That's the opening scene. There he is crying with his brothers, and they're dismayed, and they can't believe this is really happening. Now we're going to jump back to chapter 41 and see how this all began. Chapter 41, let's look at verse 1. "Then it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream." Now, first of all, remember, 2 full years. What he's talking about here is that the cupbearer had, he had asked the cupbearer, "Please remember me when you go back to Pharaoh," because he told the cupbearer the dream that he would be saved. And he interpreted the cupbearer's dream. Remember the baker? His dream didn't turn out so well. He ended up getting hanged because he got caught. The cupbearer, it turned out good for him. "So remember me when you go back to Pharaoh." Well, for 2 whole years, didn't say a word to Pharaoh. And so that's what this is talking about here. At the end of these 2 years, Pharaoh has this dream. And Behold, he stood by the river. Suddenly there came up out of the river seven cows. So he's revealing here the contents of the dream. Fine looking and fat, and they had fed in the meadow. Then behold, seven other cows came up after them out of the river, ugly and gaunt, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the river. And the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the seven fine looking and fat cows. I don't know what that looked like, but it could rather be pretty gruesome. I worked with cows. And I couldn't imagine, you know, cows eating other cows, and especially these gaunt cows. It must have been a pretty nightmarish type of thing for him to view. But as we'll see in a moment, it was. Five. Yes, thank you. He slept and dreamed a second time. So now here's the second dream that he has. And suddenly seven heads of grain came up on one stalk. So one stalk of corn, seven heads came up on this one stalk, plump and good. Then behold, seven thin heads blighted by the east wind. That gives us a little hint that this has to do with a famine, because it's an east wind. Whenever an east wind comes, that's from the deserts. What does that imply? Famine. So Joseph is actually given a little hint here. East wind sprang up after them, after this east wind came up, and then the seven thin heads devoured the seven plump and full heads. So Pharaoh awoke, and indeed it was a dream. And so he sees these plump ears of corn being devoured by these thin ears of corn, and he's very similar to what happened with the cows. And it says here, that Pharaoh woke up, and indeed it was a dream. And in other words, it was so real to him, it seemed like it was real, but it wasn't. It was in fact a dream. Now it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men, and Pharaoh told them his dream, and there was no one who could interpret them for Pharaoh. This dream upset him so much, troubled him so much, that he sent for the experts in the land, like the doctors, the guys that understood this kind of thing. He sent for them and said, come on in and help me with this. I need help. It really troubled him. I don't know if you've ever had a dream, a nightmare. Well, I'm sure you have. Most of us have, right? You've had a nightmare sometime or other in your life. But the kind of nightmare where you remember it all the next day, and then you remember it for a long time, and you can't shake the images out of your head. No, that's what's going on here with the Pharaoh. And he's upset about it, and he wants help. Verse 9, then the chief butler spoke to Pharaoh, the cupbearer, saying, I remember my faults this day. The cupbearer is making a mistake, at least if you're in a high position. I've seen this in most companies. You don't want to go, if you're in a high position, you don't want to confess your faults for fear that somehow that would make you look bad. Are you with me? Anybody in the corporate life know what I'm talking about? You don't want to look bad in front of the boss. So what you do is you try to make yourself look good. That's what happens. That's the truth. By the way, I don't agree with that. That cultural thing, this little dance that we tend to do out there in the corporate world to try to make ourselves look good. Just be who you are. We're to just be who we are and then let God take care of the rest. We are to, when given the opportunity to share our faith, we should do that, and then let God take care of the rest. We're going to see an example of this right here and right now with Joseph, where he just is who he is. He says it like it is. Interestingly enough, we're seeing the cupbearer do that. Maybe Joseph rubbed off on him, I don't know. But he's making, it would be considered... suicide as far as your future is concerned with many folks. They see that as a sign of weakness, and so they don't want to promote you for fear. We don't want a weak person in this position. You see it all the time. You see it with politicians. As soon as they confess that they did something wrong, what happens to them, especially if they're a Republican, they get forced out because they made a mistake, and forgiveness is not a very, especially in the higher positions, it doesn't work. But when Pharaoh was angry, so the cupbearer, the chief butler, goes on in verse 10, when Pharaoh was angry with his servants, This is back when he was angry with the baker and with the cupbearer. And put me in custody in the house of the captain of the guard. That would be, by the way, who? That would be Potiphar. He was the captain of the guard. Both me and the chief baker, we each had a dream in one night, he and I. Each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now there was a young Hebrew man, that would be Joseph, with us there. A servant of the captain of the guard, that once again would be Joseph, and Potiphar, because he served Potiphar. And Potiphar still isn't obviously in touch with Joseph. And we told him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each man he interpreted according to his own dream. And so, in other words, the chief, the cupbearer had his dream, and the baker, he had his dream. And so each according to his own dream, Joseph interpreted, and it came to pass, just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. He restored me to my office, and he hanged him. In other words, the baker was hanged, and I was restored to office. And it came to pass, just as Joseph had said. So then the Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him quickly out of the dungeon, and he shaved, changing his clothing, and came to the Pharaoh. You see, back then, if you approached the Pharaoh, anyone ever approached the Pharaoh, they had to be clean shaven. That was part of their culture, especially if he went into the presence of the Pharaoh. So they were washed, and they were their hair, body hair was shaved and so on, and it was a pretty big deal. And Pharaoh, verse 15, said to Joseph, I have had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. But I have heard it said of you that you can understand a dream to interpret it. So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. First time that he now says to Pharaoh, there he is standing in front of Pharaoh. By the way, Pharaoh, the word Pharaoh, some believe it could mean, it simply means the sun god. Pharaoh, Fay, is, let me see if I can remember this right. Pharaoh, Fay would be the, and let me see, Ra would be the sun god Ra, okay, or Horus. Horus and Ra are the same god, the sun god. So Fay, Ra, the sun, or the sun god. So that's, some think that's what the title Pharaoh, he's actually the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh really is just a title, and the title of Pharaoh simply means the sun god. In other words, he is deified as God. You follow that? So when Joseph says God has the answer, that could have elicited a response by Pharaoh to say, strike him dead right now. Because he's God. Who does this guy think he is to tell me that God will interpret the dream that I had? When I'm God, you insult me, put him to death. Could you see that? That's the idea here. And so Joseph was bold, though, and I'm sure he was aware of this. I'm sure he, remember, he'd already been here 13 years. And so he's very familiar, and he's no dummy, by the way. He's very familiar with it. He's speaking Egyptian by this time. He knows their customs. He knows about their gods. For him to stand up there in front of Pharaoh and to say what he said, God, not you, Pharaoh, God has the answer to your dream. Now, Pharaoh didn't get into a fuss with him about that because he was wanted the answer to this problem concerning this dream that he had. It really had an impact on him, and he wants to know. And then, verse 17, then Pharaoh said to Joseph, behold, in my dream I stood on the bank of the river. Suddenly seven cows came up out of the river, fine-looking and fat, and they fed on the they fed in the meadow. Then behold, seven other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and gaunt, such ugliness as I've never seen in all the land of Egypt. In other words, this is like a horror flick. This is aliens. This is predators, you know, one of those real ugly things, you know, their thing comes out in their face and you don't want to look at it. Okay, that kind of thing. And that it really has an impact on him. And verse 20, and the gaunt and ugly cows ate up the first seven, the fat cows, and when they had eaten them up, no one would have known that they had eaten them, for they were just as ugly as at the beginning. Now, this is new piece of information. We didn't learn that in the first time. They ate the fat cows, but they were still gaunt. In other words, it didn't seemed to help at all. Okay, so I woke Verse 22, and also I saw in my dream, and suddenly seven heads came up on one stalk and full good. And he tells him the corn story. And then he beholds, verse 23, seven heads with withered, thin, and blighted by the east wind sprang up after them. And the thin heads devoured the seven good heads. So I told this to the magicians, but there was no one who could explain it to me. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. There's two dreams, and they have the same meaning. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Okay, now God, he brings God into it again this time. God is the one who has shown you, Pharaoh, what he's going to do. He's being an evangelist here. He's actually sharing who God is, and God is revealing to you, Pharaoh, what's going on here. And verse 26, the seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads are 7 years, and the dreams are one. And the seven thin and ugly cows, which came up after them, are 7 years, and the seven empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. And this is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. So God is... touched you. God has given these dreams to you, and he's revealing to you the future, Pharaoh. In verse 29, indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt, but after them, 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land, so the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following it, for it will be very severe. And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice. It was repeated twice. In other words, you had the dream concerning the fat cows and the lean cows and the fat corn and the plump corn and the scrawny corn. It was repeated twice because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. Now, it's important to understand that when the Bible makes a double reference, obviously there's something going on here. According to what we just read here from Joseph's comment, there's something going on here that is a double answer, is basically means that it is definitely coming to pass. Nothing's going to stop it. Nothing's going to hinder it. It will happen. Jesus oftentimes would say, verily, verily, I say to you, or truly, truly, I say to you. When he says truly, truly, what he's doing is he's emphasizing the fact that this will happen. Nothing's going to stop it. One of the things that I like about Jesus doing this, I think it's in chapter... In the New King James Version, it's not like the King James Version, which says, verily, verily, I say. The modern translations will use the words truly, 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 twice. In the New King James Version, it says, most assuredly, most assuredly. There's no doubt about it. he does this in spots that are... I'm trying to remember what the number is, and it's like he uses this double reference 25 times in the book of John. 25 times, most assuredly, or truly, truly, I tell you. And I would pay attention to those. Not like the rest of the word isn't as worthy to read. That's not what we're saying here. Not saying, well, those you need to focus more on those. That's not the point. He's just saying, look, what I'm about to say is definite, and it's the truth. And sometimes we say, have you ever done this? Well, honestly. Honestly, this is what I'm trying to say. What does that imply? Yeah, but does that mean the other words I use are not honest? Is that what that means? In other words, I'm not honest on these words, but in other words, I put my hand on not just one Bible, but a stack of Bibles. You follow what I'm saying? Does that make it more true if I have more Bibles than one Bible? That's not what's going on here. That's not Jesus says, I swear on my mother's grave. That's not what he's doing here. Okay. I just wanted to make that clear. All he's saying is that, look it, he gave you these two dreams of the same thing. He's just saying it's assured. It will come to pass. Now, back in Genesis 41, verse 33. Now therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Now Joseph is taken the initiative to make a recommendation. Oftentimes, a person will come and present a problem, but they won't make a recommendation as to the solution of the problem. I'd like to suggest to you, in your wherever it is that you're working or whoever you're working for, if you have a problem and you take it to your boss, have a solution to the problem. Have a solution. State the problem. Here's the problem. But then may I be so bold as to make a suggestion as to how to handle this. That's exactly what Joseph is doing here. Let the Pharaoh do this. Verse 34, and let him appoint officers over the land to collect one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in seven plentiful years. So 20% of all that is produced out there, 20% of it stored away in grain houses. In each of the cities and the communities out there, let them set up a storage area where all the grain that is collected in that harvest, have them store it 20% over the next 7 years. And so that's his suggestion. That's his recommendation. And verse 35, and let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. Then then that food shall be as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine. And so that is his recommendation to the leader of Egypt. So verse 37, so the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all the servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find such as a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God? Can we find anyone like this now? Because Pharaoh is a pagan. He doesn't know anything about the God of the Bible. In fact, there is no Bible at this point, right? So when he says the Spirit of God, he's probably referring to the spirit of the gods. Because Elohim, the word, it's actually Ruach Elohim. That's the Ruach is means spirit or breath, the breath of God. Ruach Elohim, simply, those are the words that are used here in the Hebrew, and that's how it was put in the Bible. And normally that would be translated Spirit of God, but Elohim is subject to the context. So when a pagan god uses the word Elohim, it could mean gods, because the word Elohim, the Hebrew word Elohim, is plural for God. Did you know that? The Hebrew word Elohim is plural for gods. Okay, but here's the deal. This is an important point. I'm bringing this home to you. Elohim is the word for God in the Old Testament. The Hebrew word for God is Elohim, and it's always translated it's translated with the word Yahweh and a singular verb, singular. So whenever you see Elohim in referring to Yahweh, Yahweh is the name of the God of the Old Testament, Yahweh, that's his name. Elohim just simply means God, just like Allah is the Arabic word for God in Arabic, right? That's all it is. It's just the Arabic word. It's not the name of Allah. They claim Allah has no name, but quite frankly, that is his name, Allah. But anyway, getting back to the point, when we see the word Elohim used in the Old Testament like this, the context will determine whether it's plural or not. So in the book of Daniel, we see Nebuchadnezzar referring to, for example, the spirit of the holy gods are in Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar says that about Daniel. Some translations say the spirit of God is in Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar probably didn't believe in the spirit of God. He didn't know what the spirit of God. He knew about a spirit of God. Okay, so that's all I'm trying to say on this. So Pharaoh isn't a believer in that sense. It's just how it's translated. So he says, Can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God? Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. In other words, you're going to be number two in the land. I'll be number one, but you'll be number two. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. Then verse 42, Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, and he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain on his neck. Now, by giving him this signet ring, it's like giving him a debit card, his own personal debit card, and saying, Pharaoh's giving him Joseph his debit card and says, you do whatever you want with it. And by the way, that debit card gives him access to what? All the treasures of Egypt, right? It's like a blank check. You're in charge, Joseph. Here you go. Here's my money. You do with it as you please. I trust you. That's pretty amazing, is it not? Okay. And then it goes on and says here, verse 43, and he had him ride in the second chariot. Wow. Pretty amazing. Ride in the second chariot, which he had. And they cried out before him, bow the knee. So he set him over all the land of Egypt. By the way, we don't see any resistance from Joseph here about bowing the knee to him. That is forbidden. Any Jew, no one is to bow a knee down to a Jew. Why is that? Only God receives worship. When you bow your knee down to somebody, you are... That's a form of worship. You're laying yourself before that person. And Pharaoh says the people are to bow their knee to Joseph, right? Isn't that what it says? Bow the knee. Here we find a type of Joseph, a type of Jesus, in that just as people were to bow their knee to Joseph, so Paul writes this in Philippians 2, verse 9, therefore God also has highly exalted Jesus and given him the name, which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow. And so we see a picture here of Joseph as a type of Jesus in that sense. And as I mentioned to you earlier, we find typology throughout the life of Joseph and how he does fit the picture of Jesus in so many ways. But we don't want to make too much out of that. But that this is one of those places. And so Pharaoh places Joseph over all the land of Egypt. Verse 44, Pharaoh also said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah. Zaphnath-Paneah, what does that mean? It means the gods speak and live. That's what most commentary dictionaries, Bible dictionaries say. The gods speak and live. In other words, Pharaoh was so impressed with Joseph's response and Pharaoh immediately recognizing that what the interpretation that Joseph gave him was true. He gave a testimony to the fact that, in fact, yeah, the gods spoke through Joseph. They actually live. So that's his name. Zaphnath-Paneah. Well, that's quite a mouthful, isn't it? And so it goes on to say, okay, I lost my spot. Help me. 45, thank you. And he gave him a wife, Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On. So Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. Now, it's interesting. He marries the daughter of a high priest of Egypt, which is a pagan priest, right? Worshipping false gods. I find that interesting, don't you? Here's this daughter. She's in a high place there in the court of Pharaoh, and Joseph ends up marrying her. Can you imagine what kind of marriage that would be? With Joseph being true, strong in his convictions for the true God, and he's married to a pagan woman, but he accepted it. He accepted it. Now it's interesting. As we continue to read on about this relationship, he had children with her. It says in verse 46, Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. He was 30 years old, right? So he was, we know he was sold as a slave by his brothers when he was 17, teenager. So 13 years have passed, and now he's standing in front of Pharaoh. Pharaoh then promotes him, right? And now we're going to have seven fat years of plenty, right? Seven fat years of plenty, and then two years of famine. At the end of those 2 years is when his brothers show up. So when you add up, when you do the math, what do you have? 7 and 2 is 9 plus 13, you have 22 years. So a total of 22 years have passed by the time his brothers see him, which we'll get to in a little bit. So now, verse 47, in the 7 plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all the food over the 7 years of which were in the land of Egypt and laid up the food in the cities. He laid up every city, the food for which the fields were surrounded them. Joseph gathered very much grain as the sand of the sea, and he stopped counting, for it was immeasurable. Verse 50, so Joseph, and to Joseph was born 2 sons before the years of famine came, from whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. And Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for God had made him me forget all my toil and all my father's house. And so with this, we discover that Joseph was still bothered even after 13 plus years by what his brothers did to him. He was still hurting over that. And can you imagine, wouldn't you, if your brothers or your family had done something like that to you? And so he has this child, and so he names him Manasseh, which means God has made me forget. God has made me forget all my toil and all my father's house, the pain that I received from my father's house. And the name of the second called Ephraim, for God had caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. So not only was Joseph basically told that, I've got these in my notes somewhere, but I can't find them. Oh well, that's okay. I'll just do it from memory. So God basically told Joseph that he actually encouraged him with these two children through Potipharah. And by giving them those names, they, as is often in those days, the name of a child or of a baby would be associated with an event or a circumstance that impacted that person. It's not like us where today where we get a book of baby names and we look for one that sounds good. But children, were little babies, were named after events surrounding the circumstance of that baby's birth. For example, my niece, my brother's little daughter, they didn't make it in time to the hospital. In fact, she was born there in the house, and they're Christians and they love Christ. And because she was born in the house, in the Hebrew, the word house is Beth, B-A-B-E-T-H. So they named her Christabeth. She was born in a house. My brother delivered her actually, you know, had to take his shoelace and tie the placenta. And all. He had to cut the, you know, the placenta and all that stuff. It was pretty amazing, pretty traumatic for my brother. I'm sure he will never forget that the rest of his life. But the event was significant. And so because Christabeth was born in the house, that's very common. That's what they did in the Old Testament days, is they would name their child after the circumstances of their birth or something traumatic associated with the birth. Okay, then we read here in verse 53, then the 7 years of plenty which were in the land of Egypt ended, and the 7 years of famine began to come. As Joseph had said, the famine was in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. And so when the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Then Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph. Whatever he says to you, do. The famine was over all the face of the earth. And remember, Pharaoh gave Joseph his signet ring. It's like a debit card with an unlimited bank account there. And he put Joseph in charge of all this. So whatever he says to you, do. Verse 56, the famine was over all the face of the earth. Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, and the famine became severe in the land of Egypt. So all countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain, because the famine was severe in all the lands. Throughout that entire region, the famine was impacting. And so, of course, back in Canaan, where Jacob and his family is located, it was affecting them as well. Chapter 42, verse 1. When Jacob saw that there was grain on Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Indeed, I have heard that there is grain in land in Egypt. Go down to the place, that place, and buy for us there, that we may live and not die." You know, the sons, now they're older. They're older, and they have their families living there with Jacob. This is sort of weird to you and me. But they're living like in a community, and it's like all his grown-up sons with their families are living in the same area, and they're sort of farming the land, but there's nothing to farm. And because there's nothing to farm, their livestock suffer, right? And so they need something to eat. So he says, "Look, just don't stand there looking at each other. Do something." That's what he's saying to him. And so he sends them to Egypt. And so, verse 3, Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, "Lest some calamity befall him." And the sons of Israel went to buy grain among those who journeyed, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over the land, and it was he who sold to all the people in the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. And Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. Then he said to them, "Where do you come from?" Now, you got to understand that Joseph is speaking Egyptian, right? And they're speaking Hebrew. And so when they come, there's an interpreter there, as we learn later, where Joseph is speaking to them through an interpreter. Not only that, 22 years have passed by. 22 years. Joseph was 17, now he's 39. Now try to picture yourself recognizing your own brother from the time he was 17 to the time he's 39. Not only that, he's dressed in a totally different outfit. His hair is shaven, and he's speaking a different language. Yeah, it's possible that they didn't recognize who he was. They may not have been focused on him. They were focused on the others. He was just sort of off to the side watching all of this take place. "Where do you come from?" And they said to him, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." Verse 8, so Joseph recognized, chapter 42, verse 8, so Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them and said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." Ah, now Joseph is going to get back at them. Now this is interesting. Joseph is just like anybody else. In his heart at this moment, he's trying to figure out what to do, but he doesn't immediately tell them who he is. He wears a mask, so to speak, a metaphorical mask. He's not going to let on to them who he is. He's going to pretend. He's going to act. He's going to be a hypocrite. Oh, you know what that is? That's a Greek word. Hypocrite. That is the Greek word for actor, right? And Jesus talks about hypocrites. But he's doing this for a reason, and he's going to have a little fun, I think. I don't know. It doesn't seem to be in line with Joseph's character, but remember, he's a sinner. Remember, don't forget Joseph is a sinner. He doesn't seem like a sinner when you read about his life. We try to make him into a saint as we read, you know, oh, Joseph, he's perfect. He's not perfect. He's just like you and me. And then he said to him, verse 10, "No, my Lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We are all one man's son. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies." Are they really honest? Oh, they said they lied to their dad, didn't they, about Joseph? And so right there, they said, oh, we're honest men. Can you imagine the hair on the back of his head, if he had any hair in the back of his head, standing up after what they did to him? We are honest men, his own flesh and blood telling him they're honest men when he knows they're not. We're not spies, verse 12. But he said to them, no, but you have come to see the nakedness of the land. In other words, you're spying out the land, you're checking us out, and then you're going to come back and attack us later. Verse 13, they said, your servants are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And in fact, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more. That must have gotten Joseph a little bit, got his attention. One is no more. Oh, now we're getting to where I want to go with this. But Joseph said to them, it is as I spoke to you, saying you are spies. In this manner you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you and let him bring your brother, and you shall be kept in prison, that your words may be tested to see whether there is any truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. So he put them all together in prison 3 days. Boy, I'm having one of these. Okay, it'll pass. My eyes will get all watery. You know, I'd like to talk, but I can't. Okay. Now, I've got water. No throat lozenges at this point. It'll be clacking my teeth and you won't listen. Okay. Do you ever get one of those attacks? Well, I'm doing everything in my power not to sneeze all over you. Okay. Okay. I lost. Okay, verse 18. Chapter 42, verse 18. Okay, 3 days. Then Joseph said to them the third day, do this and live. Now he sequesters them, he puts them in a room, and then he lets them think about it. Notice for 3 days. That's an interesting number. Think about it for 3 days. And Joseph said to them the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, he's still holding on to that. They said they were honest men, and that's God. That's there stuck in his mind. Now, if you really are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison. So Joseph lightens what he said earlier. Earlier he said only one of you go back and everybody else has to stay here. Now he changes it a little bit and he says, okay, one of you need to stay behind and the rest then go back. But you go and carry grain for the famine of your houses and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified and you shall not die. So he even gives them grain. And they did so. Verse 21, then they said to one another, we are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. And Reuben answered them, saying, did I not speak to you, saying, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen? Therefore, behold, his blood is now required on us. But they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke of them through an interpreter. You see, he was listening. He understood what they were saying in their Hebrew, and saw that now the remorse is beginning to set in. And remember, Reuben was the one that said, don't do it. And so now he's going after his brothers. You didn't listen to me. I'm the oldest. You should have listened. You didn't. And now look at the trouble we're in. Verse 24, and he turned himself away from them, Joseph did, and he wept. Can you imagine how intense this must be for him? And remember, they're his older brothers. I mean, the little brother tends to look up to the older brothers, almost like you know, hey, they're the fan club. The older brothers are his fan club, and then they turned on him. The hurt must have been very deep for him. And so he began to weep. Then he returned to them again and talked with them, and he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. He didn't take Reuben. He took Simeon. I suspect Simeon and Levi were two of the culprits, because they were the ones with the hot tempers. Simeon was number two, and Levi was number three in order of birth. Verse 25, then Joseph gave a command to fill their sacks with grain, to restore every man's money to his sack, and to give them provisions for the journey. Thus he did for them So they loaded their donkeys with the grain and departed from there. But as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey feed at the encampment, he saw his money, and there it was in the mouth of the sack. So he said to his brothers, "My money has been restored, and there it is in my sack." And then their hearts failed them, and they were afraid, saying to one another, "What is this that God has done to us?" You see, their guilty conscience now is like, they're thinking now, you know, we've done something wrong. Reuben brings up to them, it's what we did to our brother way back then, and now it's happening, and we're all in trouble. And have you ever been in a bad situation where, you know, you did something wrong, and now it's coming back to bite you? And you're in big trouble, and how am I going to deal with this? And that's what they're going through. And it leads to restlessness and fear and so on. Verse 29, "Then they went back to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, and told him that all that had happened to them, saying, 'The man who is the Lord of the land spoke roughly to us.'" Joseph doesn't seem to have that kind of personality to speak roughly, but he did. "He spoke roughly to us. And took us for the spies of the country. But we said to him, 'We are honest men, and we are not spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is with our father in this day in the land of Canaan.' Then the man, the lord of the country, said to us, 'By this I will know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me. Take food for the famine in your household and be gone, and bring your youngest brother to me, so I shall know that you are not spies, but that you are honest men, and I will grant your to your brother, and you may trade in the land.' Then it happened, as they emptied their sacks, that surprisingly each man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. And Jacob their father said to them, 'You have bereaved me. Joseph is no more, Simeon is no more, and you want to take Benjamin? All these things are against me.' Then Reuben spoke to his father, saying, 'Kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you.'" So Reuben, being the oldest brother and all, taking the lead, saying, "Look, I'll give you my two sons." Well, remember, they're Jacob's grandsons, like he's going to kill his two grandsons. "Here, take my two sons. Kill them if I don't go back and get him and bring him back to you." But he was sort of speaking more out of emotion at this point. Verse 38, "But he said, 'My son shall not go with you, for his brother is dead, and he is left alone. If any calamity should befall him along the way in which you go, then you shall bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave.'" Jacob is making it very clear to his sons how serious this is with him about Benjamin leaving his side. "It will kill me. I will die if you take Benjamin away from my side in these extenuating circumstances." And so they're trying to sort this all out right now. And next week, I want to finish 43 through 45. You know where we're headed. And you know the direction that we're headed in. This is narrative. It's more narrative than it is a story of the life of Joseph. And the end result is intended to teach us about God's sovereignty, how he is in control, how he was the one who arranged the circumstances here. God, you'll recall that in chapter 39, "And God was with Joseph, and God was with Joseph, and God was with Joseph." We saw that over and over again. With Potiphar, God was with Joseph. When he was in the prison, and the guy in charge of the prison, and he gave favor to Joseph, and God was with Joseph. There was a reason behind all this. God was with Joseph for the purpose of preserving his overall plan of bringing Messiah to this earth to save you and me. It isn't as though Joseph was more special than anybody. He was a privileged person. God exalted him, put him in that spot, and God or Joseph did anything good to deserve it. That's not it so much as God is true to his name and his honor. We are going to see this theme continue on right on through the Bible. When Deuteronomy, when the second giving of the law is made, there, just before Moses dies, there in the Moab, just before they cross the Jordan, God reassures Israel that he is doing this to honor his name. You follow that? But isn't that the Jews? You see, people get hung up on this thing that God has, he's favoring the Jews. The Jews are more important than anybody else. That is not true. And this message is sending out an anti-Semitic, it sort of gives this sense to the people of the world that God favors the Jews simply because they're Jews. That is not true. We see in Deuteronomy chapter 7, we see even Ezekiel chapter 36, God says, you know, the reason why I did this is to honor my name. And what's that all come? What is that all about, to honor his name? And then we come right back to the big picture, the main point. He made a promise, here it is, to Abraham, to give him three things. The major, we call it the Abrahamic covenant, of which there are seven parts. There are three major parts of the Abrahamic covenant that deal with three things. They are land, nation, blessing. God promised Abraham and his descendants a piece of land that they would own forever. You read the book of Genesis, you cannot miss that. It's very clear. You just read it. It's there, an everlasting possession. I'm going to give you this land as an everlasting possession. I'm going to make you into a great nation, not just a nation, but a great nation. By great, he makes it very clear. Powerful and numerous. Nation. And then thirdly, I am going to bless all the families of the earth through your descendants. Now, it's interesting, when you go back and you read there in Genesis chapter 12 and 13 and so on, the translators have a problem in translating the Hebrew word to seed or offspring. Seed or, and they have trouble. You get different translations, and you'll see it, the word there, I will bless all the families of the earth through your what? Seed. It'll say that in some translations, but in other translations it'll say through your offspring. Now, do you see something going on here? I'm wrapping this up, but I want you to understand something as we look at the big picture. These three things, land, nation, and blessing, is what God is doing to honor his name, and this blessing that is coming to all the families of the earth through his seed connotes two things. The seed is also offspring. The seed is Jesus, as Galatians 3 tells us, and to seed, singular, meaning seed one, not plural. But then, you see, when you go back and you read the other passages about the seed, it can also be translated offspring, so it gets rather confusing. So the seed is pointing to Jesus, but the offspring is pointing to who? Israel. Israel. So, the descendants of Abraham will receive some land as an everlasting possession. By the way, they're back in the land today. They don't have it quite all yet. And they will be made a great nation in that land. That hasn't happened yet. Powerful and numerous, hasn't happened yet. And all the families of the earth will be blessed through them. How? Through the Messiah Jesus and through them as a nation, their offspring. So when you read Isaiah, when we come to Isaiah, we will learn in the book of Isaiah, especially the chapter 60 through 66, we will learn that the nations of the world will be blessed through Israel. That's what Isaiah says. It's very clear. You cannot read it and not understand it any other way. And so, what are we doing here? Joseph is part of the piece of the puzzle. Joseph and his brothers are part of the piece of that puzzle. God is accomplishing through Joseph and his brothers the end result will be to make his descendants a great nation in that piece of land to bless all the families of the earth. And that's why God was with Joseph. That's why. And God was with Joseph. And God was with Joseph. And God gave them favor toward Joseph. And then when we read in chapter 45 at the very beginning of tonight, how did it say? What did it say? How did Joseph? Joseph understood it. Hey, the reason why God did this was to preserve us. That's what he said, right? And that's where we're headed. And so what we're doing here as we go through the study is we're keeping an eye on the big picture, not losing sight of that big picture, because we are living in a world that's anti-Semitic. And the reason, we are living in a Christian world where the majority of Christians are anti-Semitic. Those who call themselves Christians. And we're talking about the Catholic, Orthodox, and Protestant churches. There is a very small minority who does not see it that way. And I just want to make clear that it isn't because the Jews are any more special than anybody else. God is no respecter of persons. Does that make sense? Okay, good. Let's stand. Father, Lord, we thank you for your precious word tonight that you've given us as a lamp unto our feet and a light to our path, that we would stay true to your word, and that we would understand these things, that we may grow closer to you, that we may learn about you and who you are and how you are no respecter of persons, and how you did raise up Joseph for this very reason, to bring glory to your name and to carry out those plans, those promises that you made to Abraham concerning the land, the nation, and the blessing, Lord. That you would help us to get right there in tune and recognize that we are not far away from you manifesting the kingdom here upon earth, on the earth, and bringing the Jews into an understanding of who their Messiah is. And Lord, yes, we do pray for the peace of Jerusalem. We pray, Lord, that you will bring the Jews around to accepting Jesus as their Savior. And Lord, that you will compel them into the knowledge of your Son, Jesus. You will compel them by your love. You compel them through Bible prophecy, that you will help this tiny nation, especially with our president about ready to visit him this week, that you will give their leaders wisdom to know how to be able to talk to President Obama. And Lord, that you will give them conviction to your word, and that your word is true, and that you will begin to open their eyes to the truth of your word, that your word is in fact, you do not lie, you tell the truth. You will bring to pass what you say you will bring to pass, and you will help the leadership of Israel to come and acknowledge that and recognize that, and not withdraw and not to become fearful, but to put their confidence in you. Even as Zechariah 12 tells us, Lord, that you would bring to pass what your word says about the future of the leaders of Israel, that you will bring that to pass, Lord, and you will firm up their hearts and make them strong in the power of your might, Father. And we ask this in Jesus' name, and everybody said together, you know, exciting times are around the corner, guys, and you have an opportunity to participate in what is happening simply by studying God's Word and coming together and reading it like we're doing tonight, and staying there at the big picture, because things that are happening in the world today, we're going to see a major event happen, and Israel is going to come out more. Just be one in God, and you have the privilege of knowing that beforehand, and your faith in the process being strengthened. So go out with that knowledge in Jesus' name, and be strong in the power of His might. Amen.